Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, guys. Welcome to the show. Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese. All right, let's get on to the real show. Hello, I'm Jesse McAnally.
And I'm Andrew DeWolf.
And welcome to Musicals with Cheese, a podcast where I try to get Andrew to like musical theater more. And today, we've got a special guest. It is his third time around, taking his crown as the most guested person on the show, Brent Black.
Hello, hello, here I am. I am so becrowned, kiss the rings. Hello. Hi,
it's the king of musicals with cheese. He's the cheese king.
I am the fromage royale. Hello, welcome.
Mayor
welcome
McCheese me. Himself. So how have you guys been? It's been a while since all three of us were talking.
Andrew, you want to go first?
Well, I've if you want me to go first, I absolutely will. I've been doing fantastic. I've watched La La Land about 6 or 7 times. It's just such a great movie. I really loved it. So, Brent, what have you been up to?
I have been writing a musical. It's a Star Trek parody, and working on a video game soundtrack for a game with cats that resemble potatoes, and it's called Pertato, and I'm not kidding. That's what
I've
been
doing. That's a bad pun. That is a terrible pun.
It's a very cute game. Actually, it's called A Pertato Tale, but then tail is T-A-I-L. I okay. like it, but I'm a cheesy
I think
mofo.
The double pun makes up for it, I think, though.
Oh, okay.
You have two bad puns is like one good pun.
I'm bringing the cheese to this musicals with cheese. I got a cheese plate of puns.
Someone's got to do it. Speaking of musicals and speaking of cheese, what musical are we covering today, guys?
I believe that's Matilda the Musical.
Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, nothing will change.
Matilda the Musical is a stage musical based on the 1988 children's novel of the same name by Roald Dahl. It was adapted by Dennis Kelly with music and lyrics by Tim Minchin. The musical's narrative centers on Matilda, a precocious 5-year-old girl with the gift of telekinesis, who loves reading, overcomes obstacles caused by her family and school, and helps her teacher to reclaim her life. After a 12-week trial run staged at the Royal Shakespeare Company at Stratford-upon-Avon from November 2010 to January 2011. It received its West End premiere on the November 24th, 2011 at the Cambridge Theater, and its Broadway premiere on April 11th, 2013 at the Schubert Theater. So, what do we all think about Matilda, the musical?
I think it's very good. I think it's not perfect, but, you know, it's I mean, the last one I was, the last episode I was on, as listeners, I'm sure some of them know, I was La La Land, which I really hated. This one, I won't give it a cheese rating yet, but like, I generally think it's great. It's heartwarming. It's funny when it needs to be. It has some things that irk me, but sometimes they're not the writing. They're the production that we watched, that we'll get into later. But generally, I like most of it.
What about you, Andrew?
I want to say that I've actually never read the book or watched the movie for Matilda. This is the first thing of Matilda I've ever seen. And I liked it a lot, actually. I thought it was very funny. There was a lot of like witty moments and just over the top goofy moments. And the villain is just something else. Just amazing.
Absolutely. Yes.
Whereas I think I'm like right in between you guys. Like, I grew up with the source material. It was one of the first books I read as a child as well. I loved the movie as a kid because I sought it out forever because I was a real big Paul Rubens fan. So I was like, he's in it for 5 seconds. I'm watching this movie now. And yeah, so this had like a real like nostalgic feeling for me. So when I watched the musical, it like reminded me, oh, my nostalgia's wrong. This is so much better because this is much more what Roald Dahl had intended with that original book.
Oh, you think so? Like, I'm like Andrew in this. I haven't seen the movie, though I have been in the same room as Mara Wilson and been ignored for an hour. Nice person. We didn't talk, but I have not seen the movie.
Were you guys, like, the only two people in the room? Like,
no, here's the thing. Here's the thing. We have mutuals, and, you know, sometimes when you don't know somebody and you don't want to, like, you don't want to barge into a conversation with them, so you let them lead. And by doing that, at a long table of people at a restaurant, maybe you just never address them. I shouldn't have used the word ignore. She's a lovely person. We just didn't.
They sat right next to each other and didn't speak a single time. It was really awkward. Nobody
honestly, else was there. She was diagonal for me, but everybody that I knew there was on the other side. Was on my left. She was on my right. So whatever. She seemed nice, but yeah, it was right there. Could have smelled her face. It was very, very nearby. But the point is, I didn't see the movie. I didn't read the book. So this is my first real exposure. Although I did watch some clips of the movie after to compare Trunchbulls.
I was going to watch the movie, and then I decided not to.
I find the movie very interesting because it is directed by Danny DeVito, narrated by Danny DeVito, and he plays the like abusive dad. So you've got like the
abusive. How have I not seen this movie? Holy crap.
It is very interesting to have him being very abusive and then narrating like, Matilda didn't know how to like deal with the books.
I was going to say, did he narrate with the same vocal performance style as the dad character?
Does he have a different vocal performance? Like, I think he only has one, doesn't he?
Yeah, he doesn't. There's no Shakespearean Danny DeVito, though I would pay to see it.
I disagree. He is very Falstaff.
Oh, what light through yonder window breaks.
I'm going to fucking die.
I would watch, like, do you remember the Broadway production of Macbeth where Alan Cumming played every role? I want that with Danny DeVito.
Oh my gosh. All DeVito, wall to wall.
So yes. I recently watched Twins for the first time, and I feel like that's a little Shakespearean.
Oh yeah, it's based on Two Gentlemen of Verona. If you look at Act 5, the soliloquy about the tiny brother of the tall Austrian man.
So, want to just dive into like the generalities of Matilda and all that. Like, Brent, let's just talk about what you don't like about it.
Yeah, so like, I think that it's a very, I'm sure it's an impressive adaptation. I'm sure it's an efficient adaptation. It's like a 232-page book. And I know that they've cut certain things, but a lot of things they kept. For me, I feel like often with Broadway shows, you have a situation where you want a really good actor in a certain role, but in order to get a really good actor, you've got to give them like two songs. Usually that's, in my experience, the standard is like for a supporting role, if they don't have two songs, it's less attractive. And so there are some songs that I feel like they are unnecessary to the story. They're just like sometimes charm songs. I I don't know if I actually dislike the character of Mrs. Wormwood or if I just really wish that this performer in the Broadway bootleg we watched. You know, I also heard her on, I've listened to both albums. I think that the original Mrs. Wormwood in the West End, well, they did it in the UK. And it's a UK story. So it just felt more natural, whereas the actress playing Mrs. Wormwood on Broadway just, I think the director saw the song Loud that she sings and went, okay, you're going to be loud throughout the show. But there's this like, there's this lack of effortlessness and lack of charm that makes her so often grating in a way that I feel like, you know, villains, they can be abusive and you want to see them be mean so you can sympathize with Matilda. But if someone's grating, then you don't get a chance to like love to hate them. You just kind of at certain points hate them. And yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of Mrs. Wormwood, at least in this production. I'm trying to think of other things.
Oops, sorry.
Go on.
But you have seen it live, like before. Like, how did it compare?
I did, yeah.
The touring production you saw.
I saw the recent Philadelphia touring production, and you know, the thing is, there are typically stratas of quality that you can expect. Typically, your Broadway quality is going to be one notch above your national tour quality, and then other perhaps non-union tours after that you might just like not have your expectations as high as like, you know, Friday night at a Broadway show. It was fine, but I wasn't really judging it the way that I would a Broadway show. And in that case, to answer your question, I feel like the song Loud, it's fine. It might be necessary for pacing. It's funny. The dancing's fun. But it feels like some producer went, there needs to be a dance number that's not the kids. And Mrs. Wormwood needs another song so we can get a good performer. But like, I don't love it. It's fine. It's catchy. But, there's certain moments like Quiet, which is a song Matilda sings in the second act, that it's fine, but it's unnecessary to the story. Like, we didn't need to dramatize that moment in Matilda's emotions. She could have just knocked over the cup, though it's nice. It's just unnecessary. I'm just trying to think of, I've got other things in the little document we use throughout.
Brent, are you ready to go up against me now? Because I'm going to defend both of those moments.
Sure. Now, why don't I'll save some other criticisms for later. Otherwise, I'll talk your whole ear off during this part. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pass the torch to you now.
All right. So I've gone on the record saying that the best thing about any musical theater is the fact that you're able to get that introspection, that you're able to get into a novel, but in song form. And I feel like that moment for Matilda and this moment for Miss Wormwood is both like, I am songs, like, this is my statement on life, and this is what I believe in. To show both, like, to antithesize what is currently going on both with the Miss Trenswell and the Miss Honey situations. The thing with Miss Wormwood's song, Loud, is it just happens to be fun as well. And I agree with you, it is a fine line to walk down to be, like, both charming and obnoxious. It's the same line that, like, the Thénardiers and Les Misérables have to walk. And Quiet, very much, like, you don't need that song, but it is effective and showing, like, she now has control of this, instead of just being like the Rey's a Mary Sue thing that you get in from a lot of Star Wars fans. You have that moment of introspection where, yes, this is why I can do this, because I am like suddenly in this new world of mine.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think for me, it's got a saggier second act than I think it needs. And maybe because my headspace is so in this mode right now of trying to get my own show down to not just 2 hours, but like 2 hours with laughs, which is a trap, because if the show is funny, then lots of laughing happens and then it's way too long. And if it's not funny, then it's not funny. But like, I feel like the second act of Matilda has a little bit of fat on it. And so when I look at that moment, I go like, well, is it necessary? That being said, it does dramatize the transformation. It's just like, if they were going to cut it for the Vegas, you know, 90-minute Vegas version, that'll never happen. But, you know, when they do that kind of stuff, they'd probably cut or shorten it.
I'm not sure, because that is the moment. That's what they used to market it. That's the marketing
song. It's
a short
show to begin with. Like, the whole show is only, like, 2 hours.
2 hours on the dot.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I'm of two minds about it, because it's also a kids' show. Like, 2 hours is, I think, about as long as you want to go with a show for kids. I'm not saying it's long. I am saying it, the pacing in the second act feels like they're cramming so much into it. And a lot of times with adaptations, you cut stuff out. Like, they cut out the parrot that was in the chimney, I guess, from the book.
Felt like it wasn't necessary. Like, even when I read it, I was like, oh, that doesn't feel needed.
Right, right. And I mean, like, I look at it and go, there's just something about all the stuff they have to achieve in Act Two that whether or not quiet is necessary, and it may be the kind of thing where they tried to cut it and went, oh, this is really not dramatized now. We really don't know what's going on. But for me, it's just an example of how I think some characters have songs because it's fun and it gives the other actors a break, or because it gives that actor more to do. But like, that for the narrative, I think if they had to, they could cut and it wouldn't actually affect the storytelling very much.
But the thing, like, you can cut the to be or to not to be soliloquy from Hamlet, but would you want to? Like, that doesn't teach...
That's a really long show. I'd be fine with that. That show is way too fucking long already. Yeah, totally.
I mean,
take it out.
Agreed, but that is the iconic one, and it is probably the most referenced one. Probably because it is the most introspective one. It is plot-wise useless, but character-wise, completely very essential. And I think the same thing is very true with Quiet.
I think the thing is, you like that song a lot, and I don't like it very much. I think that's what I'm getting. That's a sense that I'm getting from this.
As far as what your point, Jess, I'm not sure Matilda the musical needs to have insane introspection. It'd probably be okay without it. It is for children.
I'm defending that is a very singable moment that needs to be there. That is an essential,
you know what,
singable
it might,
moment.
It may well be the fact that, like, I, in my own writing, don't do enough of that stuff. Usually it's often characters in my stuff talking to other characters rather than us getting inside the hearts and brains, which may be a shortcoming of my work. But for me, it's like I sat there going, and to be fair, I didn't feel that way when I saw it live. I felt more that way watching this video. So maybe it's a function of I know what's going to happen and I'm just like, okay, come on. I know. Oh, quiet. Great. You know, but
and I will give you this. It is a long song that doesn't need to be that long.
Yeah, it's flabby. Like a lot of stuff in the second act just feels like, hey, this is important stuff, but like sand it down a little bit. That's all. Mm-hmm.
All right, Andrew, what problems, if any, do you have with the show?
I don't think I have any problems that I can really think of. Honestly, I think it's a good length and I don't know.
You're the one that nitpicked falsettos to fucking death.
I didn't nitpick that. I had some fundamental issues with it, which this one does not have.
I don't know. I mean, I
don't know. I feel like it was a good length, and I think I liked pretty much everything in it. Maybe the part where she meets with like the librarian or something and tells her stories. I didn't really get that part. But I might have just missed what was supposed to be happening.
Yeah, honestly, from this video we watched, I feel like it was not as clear as seeing it live. Because for me, when I finally realized, spoiler alert, that the stories that she's been telling are actually psychically the story of Mrs. Honey's parents, it was like, oh, this is why we've been randomly going to this side character over and over. Because it's really not clear till pretty late in the show. But it's hard to tell from that video that we watched.
Yeah, I don't think I even ever caught on to that. Honestly, I thought it was just like she likes books and she's good at telling stories, I guess.
Right. And it helps in that way. I think it helps keep the attention until then, but I think that the visuals of the trapeze artist and all these things are much more poignant live. And I mean, you know, not to get too meta and pull back the curtain, but I feel like it's a challenge, I'm sure, for you guys doing this show, that you can't always just get out to a live performance of these musicals, so you got to do what you can do. But yeah,
I don't live in a very good area for that.
Well, and I mean, like, having lived in New York City, Philly's, like, fine for it, but even then, like, if you're not in New York, London, or, like, I don't know, Tokyo, you know, it's tough.
I mean, Detroit is pretty good. It's, like, the third highest theater city, like, in the country, apparently, done by some rating list that I've never heard of before.
That sounds trustworthy.
I mean, big cities do have...
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, some list. Yeah, no, I've heard of some list. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, where else can I see Phantom, The Play That Goes Wrong, Percy Jackson, the musical Waitress, and Hamilton in like a 3-month period?
That's fair. I gotta say, The Play That Goes Wrong is the hardest I've ever laughed at a piece of theater ever. I'm so into that vaudevillian slapstick banana peel Marx Brothers stuff. It was great.
I just saw it last Thursday, and I had a double date old people couple in front of me, and they're like, I hated that. I was like, I didn't laugh once. Do you want to leave? We're going to leave at intermission. Like, and they just left in intermission.
Well, and that's a tour for you. I don't know if it was, I'll tell you this, and I promise this is all I'll say. For whatever reason, the second act was way less good than the first when I saw it in New York. But who knows? Tours are weird because they're pulling it all out of a box to do it over and over in different spaces. It doesn't always work. But
can I say my two cents about tours too? Because I'm gonna defend them. All right. So I've seen both Broadway tours and a few London. I think that touring productions give their all because they're more wanting to impress.
You think?
Yes, I do. Forgive me.
In my experience, like, okay, The Producers came out in 2001, and I think I saw like the third tour in 2005 or 6. And the Max Bialystock was just somebody's friend. I swear to God, he was just, or like, you know, the understudy, the swing, and the lead all died, and they were like, hey, you've got the right body shape for these costumes. Like, he was not good, and he was the lead. So maybe that's just my experience of like having lived in New York where really, really talented people are a dime a dozen. They're all hungry. To see a touring production, it must vary, because I think in many cases you're absolutely right. Sometimes stock, it's like those are the people trying harder to get noticed. But I've seen some bad touring shows, that's all I'm saying.
Or I might just be blessed, because Detroit is almost always a very early on spot in the touring production history.
Ah, that'll do it, because once the show gets rickety and they're bored, you know, it can start kind of falling apart. Now, I do have other criticisms, but I'm guessing it's cool to like organically embed those later as we talk
that's
about
what
the songs
that's
and stuff.
What, yeah.
Great.
But story-wise, like, let's just talk about Tim Minchin as a songwriter before like Matilda and all that. Have you heard of any of his previous work, either of you?
I've never heard of this guy before, to be honest.
I know his work well.
I do too. And this is one of those musicals that are very rare where every song you can just see the composer singing it at you.
Yeah.
Like, these are all
he's
very
got a real flavor.
Tim Minchin songs.
Yes, for better and for occasionally worse.
I'm with you there. So where do you think it's most effective in the songwriting?
I mean, okay, so obviously lyrics and music, he does both, but I still consider them to be very different. And sometimes a winning song can have a shit lyric. And occasionally a boring tune can actually be really fun because of the lyrics. But that being said, he's good at making stuff catchy. As I'll say soon, I think Miracle is one of the best opening numbers of the last 20 or 30 years. It's just really good at doing what it needs to do. As far as the writing, the thing about Minchin that bugs me, he's very clever as a lyricist, but he's also sometimes a lazy lyricist, in my opinion. For instance, in the song Naughty, he rhymes stupidity with happily. I could maybe get on board with like stupidity and happily, but the way it's set, it doesn't really rhyme. And I was not sure where to do this in the show, but because I'm Mr. Up My Own Ass with rules about how musical theater works, I thought I would take a minute to share the standards of rhyming that I teach kids in my summer arts program, even though I
Andrew,
don't always follow
up,
them. And of
buckle
course
those seatbelts.
Ready? Here goes.
Let's go.
Number one, generally, perfect rhymes are preferable. Pope with dope, classic Jurassic, rigidity, stupidity, not happily stupidity, and so on. Number two, I try not to do what's called an identity unless I absolutely have to. An identity is when you rhyme two homonyms like the number one with the past tense of win, which is one. They'll occupy different parts of the audience's brain, but it'll still be a homonym, so it is not as satisfying of a rhyme. Number three, not quite perfect rhymes are generally okay for like a real strong punchline, or if the character singing it is sort of being silly on purpose. Like if they're being funny, cheering up the other character, making the other character laugh with like a stretched rhyme or something, that can be organic, but sometimes it just feels lazy. Number four, hip hop near rhymes, which Tim mentioned does here and there, are only A material if they're in an impressive run, like you find in Hamilton, like Lafayette's solo in Guns and Ships. Number five, I feel the same way about bad scansion, which is sometimes called prosody. Like you don't say banana, you say banana. If you sing banana, it's like, what are you talking about? And like Tim Minchin does some of that where he'll like in Groundhog Day, he says effing like instead of fucking, but he goes effing. And it's like, that's not, it's harder for the audience to understand what you're saying because that's not rhythmically how we speak it.
Can you remind me what song that's in? I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm just trying.
That's okay. That's in the song Nobody Cares, which is like the big country western yee-haw truck chase song.
Gotcha. Thank you. That was it. No problem.
I was listening to it just today, actually. So if Bad Scan is part of an impressive or clever run of rhymes, it can be a material, but at the end of a couplet, I think it just sounds lazy. And again, an exception is if the character is doing it on purpose to kind of be funny or silly. Six singular words with their plural, like, or rather with a plural, like root and boots, are not ideal, but like not that bad. And seven, rhyming an N with an M isn't ideal, but like not a deal breaker. And finally, the type of rhymes that you use for a character should reflect the intelligence and style of that character. Like you could expect a really smart character to have more complicated and clever rhymes, but if you have a dumb or naive character, the only reason to have their rhymes be clever or complicated is if the song is clearly the author speaking through them, like the song Stuck in Tim Minchin's other big musical Groundhog Day, where clearly Tim Minchin is doing his atheist skeptic shtick by commenting on all the people who use woo-woo stuff and claiming it's medicine or a cure for something. And so these characters that he's saying are dumb, he's also using complicated and smart rhymes through them because it's really him commenting on them. And those are my rules for rhyme.
Thank you. Yes, that was wonderful. Thanks, Doss. Thank you. But where does Tim Rice's Why Go Bananas Chasing Nirvanas fit into that?
He's British, so one of my least favorite things, actually, of his is No Siree in Aladdin. Like, as a kid, I liked it, but now I'm like, that's just not a thing Aladdin would say. Aladdin's not like Opie from the Andy Griffith Show. He's not like, No Siree! Like, that's such a... He's trying to be... Tim Rice is trying to be American because he was taking over for American lyricist Howard Ashman, who had passed away. But, like, it just, you know, Tim Rice's flaws to me, and, like, in Chess sometimes, too, Freddie just sounds like an Englishman's idea of an American. But he's, like, you know, he's not bad. He's a classic lyricist in the canon of musical theater, even if he's not perfect, I think.
But the biggest thing I have with Tim Rice that Tim Minchin doesn't do is he rhymes, but it only rhymes if you sing it with an accent.
Well, I think if I could stop time and listen to all of Matilda, I might be able to refute that because there are some things, you know, this brings me to another point that I'm sure we all noticed, which is the producers and director of the Broadway version of Matilda were worried that American audiences of tourists couldn't understand English accents. So they had this really weird hybrid where it's like, oh, my O vowels are very British. But then when they had to say rhotic R's, like part, they wouldn't say pot, they'd say part. So it's like, oh, this is my part. And it's like, no, where are you from? but I don't know. I think generally you're right. It's hard, you know, it's hard when you write, because it goes both ways. I wrote a lyric for a video I did with Dave Bulmer in the UK. It was about Zelda, but at one point it was a parody of Confrontation from Les Mis. And so I wanted it to be a sound-alike to My Race Is Not Yet Run. So it was, its pace is taut yet fun. Well, in America, you can say taut, T-A-U-T, and it kind of rhymes with not. In the UK, it's taut. So it didn't work. He had to bend it to make it taut, which isn't really how he'd pronounce it. So, like, I'm of two minds about it. I think that you're right that Tim Rice does that, but I think that such is the nature of a language with multiple dialects.
Fucking English, am I right?
You are indeed.
And the whole time I thought they were Australian.
Let's talk about positives for a second. Brent.
Yes.
What do you think are the most positive elements of the show, either in the book or in the songs?
I think Trunchbull is absolutely the best achievement of the writing.
I know Andrew I keep making it about you.
Yeah. I know I keep
yes.
making this about me, but I really listened to Trunchbull before I knew I was doing this podcast with y'all. I listened to Trunchbull songs a lot in trying to figure out how the villain in my show, who's Khan from The Wrath of Khan, like, it, from what I understand, Trunchbull's pretty evil and not as funny in the book, in the movie. She's just more vile, from what I understand, and scary. But it's more fun to have a villain that you love to hate that is truly menacing, but also can have these little bits that are so funny because this person takes themselves so seriously. And the way that Trunchbull was transformed from this truly scary villain, who, as I understand it, was not as funny, transformed from that into this very nuanced, funny character, I think it's amazing and far and away more than any other character in the show, just as an invention. It's brilliant. And Bertie Carvel, I'm sure, was a huge part of that, who originated the role, but just really great. Beyond that, I mean, like I said, I take issue with certain rhymes and certain techniques that Tim mentioned we'll do in songwriting, but there are beautiful songs. There are songs that are so catchy and like harken back to a time when musicals were more concerned with just like having a nice hook that you just whistle out the doorway when you go to intermission. He's good at that, but he's also good at songs that really do three things at once and are memorable at the same time. So I've got other positives, but those are the ones that come to mind.
How about you, Andrew? What are your net positives about the entirety of Matilda the Musical?
I just really like how over the top it is. And I think the villain is like the embodiment of that, where, as Brent was saying, you just love to hate them because they're just so like full of themselves and goofy about it. But I think the father character was similar in that regard, where he's like super sleazy. Really just a lot of the bad guys are great. The mother's dance partner as well.
Rodolfo. I want to talk about how great the staging is. Like, the blue lighting throughout most of it, like, gives it a very, like, notable look.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to mention one more part. I like the staging, yeah, but, like, there was one song, I forget what song it was, but they were, like, doing almost, like, magic tricks with the letters, like, the alphabet appearing.
That was a cool song, because really cool. That song is so clever, and I wanted to save that. I love that song.
Yeah, that song is cool, and I like that a lot, and how they were, like, in the dark, putting the letters in, and then shining a light on them, so it's like they just kind of appear.
Yeah, and cool. They replicated that for the production I saw live. In fact, the production I saw live seems to have been basically using all the same, using the skeleton of the original. That being said, and I know we're on positives, but I just needed to get this out, a lot of...
Gotta go to negatives. Hang on a sec.
A lot of... Well, you know me. Come on. A lot of the choreography I found was this, like, angry robot karate shit, especially during the opener and stuff with the school children that, like, you know, in the opener, there's all this, like, I'm doing stuff with my hands and it's really fast and I'm punching the air. And it's like, no. You children are at ease with the fact that you're assholes. Why are you doing these weirdly abrupt movements that look so angry and so urgent? It just feels like weird, somewhere between, you know, martial arts, cheerleading.
There was definitely some weird stuff with movement. I remember there was one song. It might have been the same song, but, like, kids come out and they have, like, their hands on their shoulders to look like a ladder or something. It was, like, odd.
I can't remember what song that was from, but that was, I found that was an
For all the cool stuff, like I love the swings in that one song, and it makes you go like, wow, how'd they learn to swing in musical time? That's amazing. Like for all that stuff and like the discipline sign at the end of the song, Smell of Rebellion, which is such a great, like simple, like brilliant simplicity kind of thing. There's just some stuff where I just go, this is a little too angry, like, you know, like even hip hop dancing, which is a lot of that like really fast movement. It looks fun, and a lot of this stuff just had an anger to it that felt not organic to the moments where it was happening.
In the original London cast, there was a lot more cynicism to the performances, and I miss that. I miss that a lot.
Well, yeah, it feels like they kind of dumbed it. This is one thing that I really hate about Broadway, is that when it's, like, if it's an off-off-Broadway show or a niche show or, like, some cabaret at 54 Below, you can get some nuance. But Broadway shows, because they have to pack the house day in and day out with tourists, where, like, the average middle of the bell curve is a 41-year-old mother from Nebraska, and I'm not kidding. That's, like, you know, what they tell you. Producers will tell you. You kind of have to make it a few notches toward, like, the kind of, you know, when you go to Universal Studios and you watch, like, the Batman stunt show, and it's just, like, it's not exactly, you know, Passion by Sondheim. It's a little bit more dumbed down. I feel like the British people are inherently a little more attuned to cleverness, a certain kind of irony that American audiences aren't expected to be. And yeah, I think that this production just, frankly, was a bit condescending in that way. But maybe they did that because they got complaints. I don't know.
Americans just like things that are loud.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Like a lot. Americans, even the American accent is just, instead of like emphasizing certain words, you just say words louder. I just did it right there. It's like, if I want to emphasize a word, I just say it louder, whereas like British people don't do that. They just cut every other word out of the sentence and only say the one word.
Oi! Like that. Apples.
Yeah, like
but,
that.
Like
slippers.
One of my favorite parts is the opening with the Doctor and Miracle, because I agree with you. That is one of the best opening numbers in musical theater history. I think that's great. But in the original London production, he is very cynical. He's like, you're going to have a baby and like all that, and it's going to be great, and you're going to enjoy it, like, you know, in the very British way. And then in the new version on Broadway, it's like, and it'll be wonderful and happiness and wonder, and you'll be great and happiness. And I'm like, no. Londoners are never happy.
Now, Jess, I'm really intrigued because the first exposure I had to this show was my buddy Dave in the UK, who said, you've got to listen to this Matilda show. And he played me Miracle. And at least in the recording, you know, when the doctor's like, a new life, the most beautiful, you know, like thing that can happen to you. Was I just mishearing the irony? Because it felt for me pretty genuine in that London cast recording.
It felt genuine, but like sincere. Whereas the American version feels like happiness and wonder, you know, like Peter Pan or some shit.
Oh, it's a little bit goopy.
Yeah, it's a little bit too much Hallmark Channel, and less like, you know, this is what a fucking kid's about, you dumb bitch. Which is what I got in the original London cast.
While we're on the subject, I have two thoughts. Number one, who the fudge is that dude with the balloon supposed to be at the beginning? Is that Roald Dahl? Or like, I just assumed in the original, when I listened to the album, I just assumed that was the doctor, who would be just as good of a person to come on and talk about kids these days. But I just don't know who that guy is, and he never comes back. Who are you?
He's the birthday clown.
John Wayne Gacy.
It's John Wayne Gacy. You notice you don't see some of those kids ever again?
Ah, right. Well, you know, at least he kills the asshole ones. Okay, that being said, I am obsessed with the nuanced difference between the way that London audiences responded to a fart joke and the way that American audiences respond to a fart joke in the first song. So Mrs. Wormwood doesn't know why she's got this huge belly. And in the British version, she's like, you know, he goes, you really don't know. And she goes, wind? which in British English means you've got gas, you're bloated and you've got gas. Over there, it really works. I think it's because they're a little bit more embarrassed about, well, everything, but it works when it's wind. But that's not a thing we say in America. So instead, she goes gas, and it just, you can hear it in the video we watched. I experienced it when I saw it live. It just doesn't land the same. And like, it should. Like, rhythmically, it's like a pretty good fart joke. This lady doesn't realize why her belly has got a watermelon-sized protrusion, and she thinks maybe it's gas. Like, but it just, the word gas isn't funny as a punchline in the same way, unless I'm wrong. Did y'all laugh at that?
No.
There you go.
I think that she should have just said fart, and then everyone would have been like, oh.
Am I full of farts?
Am I full of farts?
Well, let me talk about like the differences between the American and London cast, because there's a lot of Britishisms removed, which I think removes a lot of the charm of the original London cast. And I know we're kind of harping on that, but this is something that bothers me. But like, one of my favorite Londoner expressions is not, N-A-U-G-H-T. And she says that in loud, like, doesn't matter if you don't know not, which means if you don't know anything. And she changes it in the American version to, I believe, if you don't know yet, which I'm like, that's not as charming. And there's a lot of other examples of that within the show. And I'm like, really, are Americans so dumb that we can't take a little bit of like,
yes,
that's the thing, Broadway. Broadway. It's the saddest thing that Broadway is where musicals come from, but in order for them to get there, they have to be the kind of script and the kind of performance. I'm not trying to be classist. I'm not trying to be coastal instead of middle American, but there's just a level of theatrical sophistication that you don't find as much in Lincoln, Nebraska as you do in Brooklyn. And they dumb it down because they want people to understand and enjoy it. And if they don't, it doesn't really matter if the work's good. If people aren't equipped to enjoy it that way, you kind of have to change it for your audience, even though I agree it dilutes it. One thing I thought was interesting is in the song The Smell of Rebellion that Trunchbull sings, in the original cast, she said when something about once they go to phys ed, they shall be too pooped for dreaming. That's the original cast. And in the American Broadway thing we saw, and also the one I saw in Philly, it's they shall be too pooped for scheming. And that's a much better lyric because I don't know why she's talking about them dreaming. She's worried about them scheming. But what I'm really curious about and I don't know is, was that originally a thing that they were just like trying to Americanize it? Or was that Tim Minchin going, oh, this is actually much better. Let's just change that.
Well, a lot of lyricists just change their lyrics as time goes on. Like, Phantom of the Opera has undergone, like, 45 different lyric changes.
Oh, my God. Well, at a certain point, that's just tinkerism.
George Lucasism.
Exactly. You know, Sondheim says, a show is never finished, only abandoned, and that's like a cliche in the theater. And, of course, sometimes when you ship a show over to another country, you change it, or you just go, you know, we're in the third year, why don't we tighten up the script? But too much tinkering is that's exactly right, Andrew. It's like, just leave it alone. Let people memorize it. Because if you change the lyrics, they're going to be irked by it not sounding like the album when they go see it.
How about I defend the other side of that, where theater is a living, breathing thing, unlike a film, where a film is a tangible thing that we all see. Theater can change night to night, despite anything. Like, even Sondheim's most recent version of Company has significant lyric changes from him because A, the new lead character is a female, and B, like, there's a couple different gender changes, and you have to change the context of that for that. And I think his new lyrics are, in fact, better because he is now more aged because of that. And I think that's the joy of theater. You can change it without, like, really causing any negative effects to what previously existed.
I think that you're right. It's more just like so many of the shows I love because I heard the album way before I ever saw the show. Like Rent. I think most of us that were alive in the mid-90s and loved Rent, like probably 10% of the people that loved the album saw the show. And so if you go into the show and the lyrics are largely different, it's like if you're a fan, it's irksome, even though if you're brand new to it, it's a better lyric. So I'm just saying if at all possible, try to nail it down and make sure it's as good as it can be by the end of previews when you lock it in, you freeze it, and you record the album. It's not always possible, and God knows I'm a tinkerer at this point in development, and like you can always wake up in the night and go, oh shit, it should have been scheming, not dreaming, but I don't know. I think it's the aim. It's kind of like video games. Back when you couldn't patch a game by downloading an update, you had to really make sure it was right. And too much updating, after a while, it's like it seems like it was lazy in the beginning. They just didn't feel the need to make it finished and polished. That's all.
Or it just feels too different from what was like, originally released.
Oops. Right.
But then you got things like Be More Chill, which has been in existence for a while. It's had a fan base. And now they've made significant changes that have both changed character and intent within the show. And I think that's all for the better. Like, especially with this Broadway run.
Quick name drop. I am maybe not friends, at one time friends, now just friendly because we've drifted, but with Joe Iconis, and he deserves every bit of this. He's been working his ass off for so long and finally got a break. But Be More Chill, here's the thing. It's going to Broadway because it's popular with a demographic of teen millennials. But they'll love it just the same, I guess. But if they love it because they've memorized the album and then they go see this revamped production, like, obviously, if it needs rewrites, you got to do it before you go to Broadway. But I think that it's just as much irksome for people that got used to one version of it as it is better for an audience that's never seen it. It's just a trade-off.
Well, I'm going to offer a counterexample. Jesus Christ Superstar. I love that musical with every ounce of my heart. It has some pretty bad lyrics in it.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's, and what is truth? Is truth in changing laws? We both have truth. Are mine the same as yours? Which does not rhyme in any sense of the word unless you're talking with a very thick British accent. And now they've changed it. It's so much better.
I'm surprised that I defend rhymes within a dialect in a way that you don't. Because to me, it's like every character has a dialect, and sometimes it's really fun to play with how things rhyme differently with a dialect. But I guess what I'm saying is, why would Tim Rice write a rhyme for you, for an American, when he's producing the original over in the UK and he's lived there all his life? You know what I mean? Like, are you saying that he should write a rhyme that works in both? Because a lot of rhymes do, but a lot just don't.
I'm just saying, like, you have to have a real thick British accent to make laws and yours rhyme.
Laws, yours. I mean, it's a stretch. It's a stretch.
I know he was very young. He was, like, in his mid-20s when he wrote that. But I appreciate when writers are able to go back and change it to be, like, and now in the more recent productions and in the John Legend version, it's like, you think it is truth. Not easy to define. Now, what is truth? Are yours the same as mine? I'm like, that's much better. That's all. That's the main point. And I appreciate that.
Totally.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I think that people are allowed to update their art as long as we still have the previous versions to, like, take in and enjoy.
But we don't. When you have a stage show and it's not being performed anymore and it's being performed by something else, you don't have the old version anymore.
You have the album. Because
it's a living, breathing
film,
thing. But
exactly.
But the thing is that it being living and breathing also kind of means sometimes if something was different earlier, if it doesn't survive, it's just a trade-off. Like, film is forever, which sucks if you make a big mistake.
Unless you're George Lucas.
I think, right. But, like, it's sort of like... It's sort of like whether you look at theater as going to see a concert of a song you already like or going to see a brand new story. And I think that if you're going to see a brand new story, it's always better for the lyrics to be tweaked and finished and perfected and the music and everything. But if I'm going to go see, you know, some band that I've loved for a long time, if I'm going to go see Green Day and they're going to play Do You Have the Time, you know, but like the rhymes are different because they thought it would be better. I know that's not a one-to-one analogy, but I think sometimes theater goers can be like, wait, what? It's just, I mean, we're really agreeing ultimately. I just think that if you're going to do that, know that you're going to take certain people that are already big fans out of it because they're expecting a different thing, though it may be a much better lyric or a much better rhyme.
So I think in every new production of every revival of a Broadway show, we should add Jabba the Hutt and make sure that the story is all fleshed up and make sure Jabba the Hutt has his part.
And way more things flying outside every window.
Exactly.
There needs to be a part for every instrument at all times. The score has to be very dense.
Yes. Absolutely. Constantly. I'm going to just keep going until we change the subject or change the segment. I think I know how they did the chalk trick, but I'm honestly not sure. I have a theory. I want to know what you guys think.
It's on a string. The chalk is on a string and someone's puppeteering it. That's how they do it.
I know how they did it in the movie.
Write on the chalkboard.
I'm wondering if it's like a projection in not...
That's the thing. I think it's either rear projected or it's maybe like an LCD backdrop that is framed as a chalkboard. But it's live. It is spooky because for whatever reason, the light hits it and the shadow, it looks pretty real live.
I feel like it can't be a screen. I think a screen would be too obvious.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I mean, stage lights would reflect off of it and stuff like that. I feel like I don't think it would work right.
You can light a thing so that a screen has enough lumens and it's not washed out, but it is difficult. And I bet if we Googled enough, we could figure it out. But I just kind of looked at that and went, that is such a great it's a moment in the book that you go, well, you could never do that on stage. And, you know, there is, in fact, a 1990 musical of Matilda that seems to be lost to time. And I wonder with the much different technology they had back then, like if they did that moment, how did they do it? We'll probably never know, but it is interesting.
According to the film originally, they used a magnet. I'm willing to believe that's kind of close to how they did it.
But the thing is, like, the pressure it requires to write, like a magnet, how would a magnet not write a constant line? But still move the chalk around.
I think rear projection is the most likely, in my opinion.
Here's an internet response. I cheated, if you guys care.
Just, no, I want to know.
Not cheat? Are you kidding me?
Well, first off, the chalkboard isn't even a real chalkboard. It's a sheet of plastic made to look like one. But It's behind a screen with letters and light, and there are people in a space behind it with a few magnets. Because some of the pieces of chalk are fake and have a metal tip, then they just trace along with the magnet while the lights let the letters bleed through. So basically, so they follow it with a magnet.
It isn't
with a
chalk,
real light.
It's light that's been obstructed and is now getting to shine. Like, it's getting to penetrate. That's brilliant. I love shit like that.
Theater is awesome, isn't it, guys?
Yes. Yes.
That's just a straight
up magic
trick.
To think it's pretty swell.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I'm going to need a little more persuasion.
So, guys, what is our favorite song from the show? Because I know we all have very different ones, or at least from the general consensus. What is our favorite songs from Matilda the Musical?
Yeah,
Andrew,
you
go first.
I like the one song. What the fuck was it called? Holy, the Smell of Rebellion.
Ah,
it's
yeah.
So good.
The smell of rebellion, the stench of revolt, the reek of rebuilders and plotting, the whiff of resistance, the pong of dissent, the funk of moral fibrati.
Pretty much everything about it, the way that they stage it, the actual song itself is very nice. And the character is just, it's cheese on a platter. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I think it's up in my top three. I think it's the best combination in terms of the staging. It's the best combination of music, lyrics, and movement in the whole show. It's not my favorite song per se, but it is very good. And like, just the way that they make it. It's storytelling, and she's scary, but also they just throw in some vaudeville shit. Like, yep, and now she's going to do this insane gymnastics leap and then and then do a thing about Zeke, the carnival freak, and the horses. And it's like, this is – you're getting a full buffet of theater in this very short space of time. It's very good.
That was a very impressive leap, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you know, it's required
for the,
role. And I think most of the time they cast, you know, men 5'11 and up. So it's a big dude who doesn't want to, I mean, I guess nobody wants to land bad, but it's usually like a pretty serious tall guy. That being said, Andrew, were you done talking about it? I was going to move on to mine if you're all set.
I'm all set. I think I've pretty much covered what I wanted to say.
Cool. My favorite song is Naughty. I don't adore the staging and like the way that they do the interlude of mixing up the hair tonic and stuff. It's like, it's fine. It's got to happen because of the story. But to me, it breaks up the momentum. That being said, the tune I find very charming. I think the chorus is this really nice, like sometimes you can make a song basically a little bit bubblegum, like it's got that kind of Brady Bunch. But the melody really has heart. And really has a soaring quality without being too goopy and too ballady. And on top of that, the song is doing so much. It's talking about books, which is this whole theme. It's talking about how Matilda has this shitty life, but she's not accepting it. It's talking about consent. It's talking about abuse. It's talking about how you don't have to accept the bullshit that happens to you, even though the world wants you to think you do. It's like the whole concept of the show, somehow every important piece of the show's themes and what you're about to see is summed up in it in a way that the opener was about all the other asshole kids. This is Matilda's introduction. And it's just so well done and so multifunctional, weaved all together. And I can't get out of my head. You know, the Smell of Rebellion's fun, but it's not as catchy, in my opinion. So that's why Naughty's my favorite.
Okay. I kind of have a tie for top two favorite songs, and neither of them are the ones that you pick, so that makes me feel good. All right, so I really, 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 really love the school song.
To survive this mess by being a prince or a princess, you will soon see there's no escaping tragedy.
it's a really clever song lyrically, where first, like, there's three versions of the chorus. First time is just normal. Second time is just like, oh shit, that's like the alphabet. Like, they sing the alphabet, like, within that, like, little lyrical, like, what the fuck am I saying? Stanza, basically. And then third time, it's like, oh, I can finally enjoy this. So it's like a pleasurable experience to listen to it. Every time it comes up on my shuffle, I'm like, ah, oh, I'm in for a ride. And the second one is I'm Here.
I am here, little girl. Please don't cry. Dry your eyes. Wipe away your tears, little girl.
Basically, it becomes very clear that this is Miss Honey's origin story, how she became a mild-mannered teacher.
Is that the one where, like, her ghost dad has a really sweet moment, or am I mixing that
yes.
up?
Yes, that's it.
Oh, yeah, that made me, I cry more and more at stuff as I get older, but I definitely teared up, like, I don't know why I'm feeling like this, but, like, it was lied, it was a lot, it was really sad.
And it really is just an emotional thing, and I really like the spoken patter of Matilda reading the story in sync with the dad, like, at the same time. Like, that is really powerful to me, and I don't quite know why that is.
Well, and, you know, what I kept thinking, for better and worse, on that point is, you don't have, in production to this show, you usually have three or four Matildas, because you just, you know, they don't want to, They really need to make sure they have multiple understudies, because kids are, by their nature, not professionals the way that an adult is. And also, you know, a kid just can't spend that much time and have a full-time job doing this show. They got to go to school and stuff. But the idea that they have to have that much precision with all the other actors who themselves may be understudies, themselves may be swings. I know they probably do a brush-up rehearsal during the day, but it's impressive. And sometimes maybe a bit clunky because of this, but it's impressive how in sync a lot of it is, considering that.
And also, the chorus is just kind of catchy. The I'm here, like, section is like, it gets trapped in my head where I'm just kind of like, don't cry, I am here, little girl. And the romanticized, like, notes in that. And I think that's part of why I kind of like, quiet a bit, is because that's kind of reprised in the opening, like the intense, like, opening time here. I think it's like one of the most effective moments, and it's even more like, it's kind of exclamation pointed when Miss Honey sings My House, and it's like reprised, and it's like, oh, all of this is coming together.
Yeah. I almost wish they could have found a way to make the act break a little bit later, so that the second act didn't, for me anyway, feel kind of like so packed full of stuff that it just kind of felt like it, you know, was a little long. But the thing is, for me, My House is this beautiful moment, and you're figuring out all this stuff that's really important and, like, really telling you finally why you've been sitting through all this. But for me, both times that I've seen it, by the time you get there, I'm like, okay, like, what do we have left to wrap up before we're done with this? Because this is really starting to, you know. And again, Andrew, you think it's not too long. For whatever reason, I just feel like it starts to sag. But that song is, to me, in the shadow of the ticking clock of, like, what's going to happen next? I can't tell where this is going structurally.
Hi guys, sorry to interrupt you in the middle of the show, but I wanted to tell you that today's show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese to get started today. Why Audible? Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, and entertainers. So, this week, probably not that surprisingly, we are recommending Matilda by Roald Dahl.
Oh, ho, ho! Sorry.
Did I shock you there? Did I throw y'all off? Kate Winslet would not be the choice that I would have picked, considering that she threw the diamond at the end of the Titanic. She threw it right off the ship. How did she have time to read a book after that? To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese. Again, that's audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese for your free audiobook. It's free. Come on, do it.
Jess, you know the Titanic was a movie, right? That was just all makeup.
What? That wasn't a real old lady? That wasn't really Kate Winslet?
It was just Kate Winslet in makeup.
And you know how long it took to get that makeup on? It's been 84 years. Anyway.
The meme. All right, let's get back to the show, guys.
Look at you hesitating, hand shaking. You should be embarrassed. You're not a little girl. It's just pathetic. Knock on the door, Jenny. What are you waiting for? Just knock on the door.
Right. One of the stuff I'm actually like skimming the doc because I think that you two have much better, you're much more used to the rhythm of how the show goes. And like my listening to it on my shower speaker doesn't infuse me with the sense of like what's going to come next to talk about. So my notes in this document are all over the place, but we've gotten to most of it. I did want to say the song Pathetic.
I'm glad to hear that you're listening to us in your shower. I'm very happy.
Oh yeah. No, I mostly hear your voices when I'm nude and wet is what I want you to know. So
I'm
that's...
hoping you are right now, to be honest.
I'm one of those things. That sucks. Okay. I'm gonna just stop us right there. I'm gonna stop.
I don't know why you'd be wet right now, but
I can think of a few reasons.
I am putting a bow on that line of thought. And so what I'm gonna say is Pathetic as a song, which is the one where Miss Honey just can't force herself to knock on the door. So often in classic musicals, you have like the I want song or the I am song. This song is both without ever saying I want or without ever saying I am. It's brilliant exposition because you know so much about this character from what her current conflict is. And you learn about her relationship with Trunchbull. You learn about her timidity in general and what she has to overcome in this story. It's very good. Even if it's not like the most catchy or the most entertaining, it's just a really good multifunctional piece of musical theater.
It's the most Sondheimian, too. It feels very much like a pastiche of Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah, it's not so Mincinian. I'm going to just make up a word there. But I feel the same way about the Mancinian Candidate. Great movie. The Hammer is another song that I feel like Trunchbull, there's a lot to set up there. But just like Matilda sees the world through books, Trunchbull sees the world through the discipline of having to be good enough to be a hammer throwing champion, which also it's not a shot put, it's a hammer. Like it's all so rich with like it's telling you so many things at once. When I Grow Up is yet another song where I'm like, this is a good song and it might be there for pacing reasons, and it does come back later when Miss Honey reprises it, but I think if you had to cut the show down, you could lose it. It's cute, it's catchy, but like I don't think it's narratively necessary.
Brent, let's come see. On. When you start Act Two, you can't have a narratively necessary song. You have to let people sit the fuck down. Come back from their smoke breaks. Masquerade is not a narratively important song. No,
Jess,
Act
we've
One
already
open,
gone over
Act
that you're
two.
Not supposed to take a break. No breaks during the intermission.
Did you know that most actors haven't peed in 8 years or more? They never get to stop.
Before you go to the theater, open up your Musicals with Cheese theater going kit and take your laxatives. Remember, two poops before you get in the theater.
If you don't, that's your life now. So,
but name one Act Two opener that is actually plot relevant.
An Act Two opener that is plot relevant. Oh, I have the worst, most obscure and terrible example. But
pull it out.
That's like the opposite of an example we want.
Well, but the thing is that it, even though it's from a shitty show, it actually works in its context. So I've been seeking out every other Star Trek musical, and there's one I don't really want to diss it too much because it's well-intentioned and the author, who knows, the author might listen to your show, but it's called Boldly Go. And it's just a very, like, college-y, written by a 20-year-old show. Not that 20-year-olds can't write a good show, but it just feels young. And so the second act opener is like a minor key version of the opener where you learn what has changed in between acts because now things are dark and you learn a bunch of stuff. Also, what about Into the Woods Act 2 opener? They tell you all kinds of stuff. They're new
wishes.
Yeah,
but it's literally just a reprise of the first act opener. Like, word for word.
You said narratively important. You didn't say not done before in the show.
Is it really that narrative? Like, I feel like most things are
pretty
set up by
the
end of Act 1.
You find out all their new problems. The baker and his wife got a baby. Yeah, now they're having trouble having a baby.
Don't spoil it. I'm really excited for that, Andrew, to watch that one.
I can't wait to find out because I have strong opinions, but I will not share them now. But yeah, I see what you're saying. I think a lot of times, I'm dealing with this myself right now. Sometimes you want to open Act 2 with just like we get back in your seats and we're going to like remind you how fun this is before we get back into the story. And charm songs can sometimes be the most fun even if they don't contribute. But I guess what I'm saying is the song When I Grow Up, to me, it's fine. And maybe it was a little boring this time because I've heard it and it's just not super visually exciting or super funny. It's just kind of pretty. And it feels like when you're listening to like one of those podcasts that's actually like an NPR show where they just do 60 seconds of music in between segments. It's like, okay, I'll sit through this. Mm-hmm. It's pretty, I guess. All right.
I mean, how does it compare to It Was a Real Nice Clam Bake from Carousel?
Okay, your question is the premise that I think Rodgers and Hammerstein is like the pinnacle of narrative in musical theater. Like they do a lot of like
narrative in musical theater. Come on.
Okay, sure, but like Citizen Kane is not exactly the summer blockbuster of 2019. Like, you know, like what came before made what there is now. But like that's okay. Real quick, I just have to ask, Jess. Are you familiar with the musical of musicals, The Musical?
What?
Okay, it's a show called The Musical of Musicals, The Musical, and I swear to God, it's not only right up your alley, but I wonder at what point Andrew would start to really get all the jokes, because it's such, it's such a reference-y show. What they do is they take the basic plot of, oh no, I can't pay the rent, I'll pay the rent, you know, like, basic musical theater story, or rather melodrama story, and they do like 15 to 20 minute musicals of this story in the style of Rodgers and Hammerstein, Sondheim, Jerry Herman, Andrew Lloyd Webber, and Candor and Ebb. And they make all these references to their shows and they do all these different styles. But if you're a real musical theater nerd, listening out there, or Jess, clearly you are. And even Andrew, I'd love to know what you think. It would be interesting to find out, but the album...
Very interesting, I'm sure.
Once you're like 200 musicals in, you'll be like, ah, I got that one joke. But like, it's if you know the styles really well, it's brilliant because it's like all the songs and yet none of them. And it's making three jokes at a time. Like the first song in the Rodgers and Hammerstein one, this guy named Big Willie, who's really like Curly from Oklahoma, he's in a cornfield and the song is called Oh, What Beautiful Corn. So it's like he's doing that Oh, What a Beautiful Morning thing, but it's actually saying Rodgers and Hammerstein is this beautiful corn, like this beautiful yet corny stuff. Anyway, I don't know why I'm suddenly shilling for this show, as if they, you know, as if you're, I'm going to send you to the website and give you like the checkout code. But I'm just saying before I forget, for those listeners and for Jess who are really into lots of musicals and are musical theater buffs, it is just a singular experience of validating your fandom.
I was just reading through the track list and I felt validated. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah. Oh, just wait. I mean, it's a good listen, and there are actually some songs in it that, like, they're catchy without exactly ripping off the original. Like, they just did a really good job synthesizing the sounds. That being said, Jess, did you want to talk about the adaptation process and some other things related to that for Matilda?
Oh, sure. Let's do that before we wrap up. Because as soon as I, like, go past the hour-long process, I'm like, probably should wrap this up soon.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair. I mean, look, we'll just point out what you wrote down, which is that Willy Wonka is the only other musical adaptation of Roald Dahl that has ever been turned into a successful show.
Yes. And I'm wondering why that is. Like, do you feel like Willy Wonka successfully Americanized Roald Dahl's material, which is very, very British? I was just wondering, why do you think it's so hard to adapt Roald Dahl's material to, like, musical theater, when really the content says that it should adapt very well?
Well, in one case, it's because a three-story giant is difficult to put on a stage. and Broadway's King Kong has showed that it doesn't lead to a good show. Sorry, King Kong. You suck.
But then you got James and the Giant Peach by Pasek and Paul.
I mean, honestly, I think that a good James and the Giant Peach could exist. I think that the movie was Randy Newman, who knows how to write a catchy tune, but his lyrics are weird. He's always writing for his voice, and then when you get, like, freaking Daphne from Frasier singing his lyrics, it's like, you've got this English grasshopper, and he's saying, I've got you, boy. And it's like, that's such a Randy Newman, like, I got you, boy. Like, it doesn't work, because Randy Newman doesn't know how to write.
That's why I can't enjoy Princess of the Frog, because I'm just like, I got friends on your side.
He's got his style is we've talked about. I know you want to wrap it up, but he wrote a concept album. Randy Newman wrote a concept album in the 90s that you should listen to called Faust. That is an adaptation of the Faust myth, but Randy Newman plays Satan.
I've heard
joke.
It's wonderful.
Well, the thing is that there's this song where Satan's like, okay, all you angels, gather around me. I'm going to tell you a story. And it sounds so spooky and so Tim Burton. And it's like, ooh, what's it going to be? And then he comes in with this You Got a Friend in Me shit that's like, you know, can't keep a good man down. And it's like, this is just the same old shit, Randy Newman.
Randy Newman, you did it again.
I mean, yeah, like it is the Mad TV sketch where all of his shit sounds the same. Anyway, James and the Giant Peach, if Tim Minchin took it on, it could be really great.
But because it's Pasek and Paul, literally the most boring composer / lyricist I've ever heard in my entire life. And that is saying, as a fellow Michigander, I feel that musical is not a... They wrote La La Land, the lyrics of La La Land.
Really,
Jeremy
really?
Hansen. Yeah.
Wait a minute. I'm not quite as brain connected as you. Dear Evan Hansen was the same team as La La Land?
Lyricists. They were brought on to do the lyrics.
Okay. That I can accept. Most of my problems with La La Land were directorial and big picture stuff. Like, the lyrics weren't all ass. They just, you know, didn't fit
the lyrics
context.
Weren't all good either. They were general and idyllic.
True. I almost feel like we've already done that episode, though, and I went way too long on it. So I think I've said all I want to say.
I mean, you didn't talk about the superhero story stuff you wanted to talk about.
Oh, that's true. Well, you know, okay, so on this viewing, I started to think, you know, Matilda's kind of a Mary Sue. Like, she's kind of, like, good at everything, and I don't understand. Her only tragic flaw seems to be, like, she gets herself in trouble or imperiled because she's being heroic, which is, that being said, I talked to my girlfriend about it, and she was like, yeah, well, you know, thematically, the idea is that the world doesn't treat children who are, doesn't value the things that make Matilda good. Matilda is a symbol of something one should value. It kind of like the Shakespearean quote, like, in a world full of fools, 'tis folly to be wise. So ultimately, she's a DC Comics character. You love her, but she doesn't have a weakness like the Hulk.
Is this the part where I try to pitch to you that this is not actually a Matilda standalone film, but a prequel to Carrie the Musical?
Whoa! I think it is that part, sir.
I mean, you've got a single mom as Miss Honey that, like, has this devoted, like, love to her daughter, a girl with telekinesis, like, she's smart, but the people don't respect her.
Dude, that's, I mean, I want to know why she stopped calling herself Matilda, but, like, you're definitely onto something.
Probably something to do with her mom going off the rails.
Could be.
I mean, her
for sure.
Her original parents, like, got caught by the mafia or something. They're in, like witness protection.
Maybe that's why they had to change the names.
Yeah.
Aha. Now we know. It's all in the same universe. You heard it here. It's canon.
Matilda grows up to kill all of her fellow classmates because she had her period in the locker room. Apparently moving to, the neurotic lady's house wasn't the best idea.
Just because you find you're covered in pig blood.
Does Miss Honey start teaching gym class and she's like the one that encourages Carrie?
All right, so that was our show, guys. So what is our cheese ratings and our overall thoughts on Matilda? Andrew, I'm going to let you go first.
Cheese. I'm trying to think of like a very British cheese, but I can't think of one because I'm terrible.
Wensleydale.
There you go. Jess gave me one. Thank you. Because it's very British and it's very cheesy. So that's why. And I liked it. So I recommend it highly.
What about you, Brent?
Well, so because I went to grad school for musical theater writing, I'm not actually legally allowed to give an A+ to any musical ever. But it's very good. So because of that, you know, sharp cheddar is aged around 12 months. Extra sharp is aged for 18 months. I don't think this show is extra sharp, but it is sharp. So I'm going to say 12 months aged sharp cheddar.
Poignant.
Thank you. I'm doing my best.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give it cottage cheese. Because it works very well with fruit and is a very sweet tasting thing, and it's got little chunks of happiness inside of it, and you're very well off after you eat it. And for a while, people thought it was... What was that?
I just want to know how Matilda the Musical works well with fruit.
Well, look at Bertie Cavill and tell him
okay.
It doesn't work.
All right, I see the road you're going down. Okay.
Maybe it should have gotten like a cheese and crackers since it's good for kids.
Maybe.
I don't know. There's a lot of talk about a girl not having a penis in it, so.
Well, I mean,
that's
kids
true.
Need to learn this kind of thing.
Yeah, where else are they going to learn it than a Broadway show?
All right, so that was our show. Wow, that was a lot of fun. Brent, I'm sure you've got tons of things you want to promote. Lay them on us.
Okay, well, I'll focus on the ones that are pertinent to this show. I spent many years doing comedy songs about video games, so if you're into that and you want to see examples of my music and lyrics, for better and for worse, that's Brental Floss, which is all one word like dental floss, but Brental Floss. On YouTube. Keep in mind, I started doing it almost 11 years ago, so there's some stuff that doesn't age so well. I've changed. However, I'm currently writing this Star Trek musical based on The Wrath of Khan, and I have a semi-secret community on Twitter and on Facebook. On Twitter, it's at UASTPM, and on Facebook, if you just search unauthorized Star Trek parody musical, you can't miss it. I think it's actually facebook.com/trekparodymusical. If you want to follow that, hear
shit.
New songs, and yeah. So show up.
It's like
love
underground.
You
we're getting the inside scoop here.
Yeah, no, it's the ground floor. I don't want Paramount and CBS to find it yet, but I do want people that are into this stuff to be able to chime in and go, hey, that was good. Hey, change this. Hey, here's what I think. It's pretty fun.
Excellent.
All right, Andrew, do you want to lead us out because I lead us in?
Oh, good God.
Do the
well,
final audible thing,
do?
And I'll do the rest. Just do the final audible thing, and I'll do the rest.
Oh, my goodness. All right.
Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/musicalswithcheese. That is the name of our show, so...
Thank you guys for listening. Please download us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. We're all at Musicals with Cheese. Subscribe, get us more views. Our Twitter is at Cheesy Musicals. Our Instagram is at Musicals with Cheese. Our YouTube page is at Musical Theater Lives. Pretty soon we're going to be doing another review raffle where we give a $25 Amazon gift card to any random person that has reviewed our podcast. So get your reviews in before it's too late. Our email is musicaltheaterlives@gmail.com. Shoot us an email if you want to ask us questions. Our title card was created by Jolene Casco. Her Instagram is at Jolene Casco. Anything else we want to say before we wrap up, gentlemen?
It's been fun. Thanks for having me. And, till next time.
Anytime you want to come on, you're always welcome, Brent. There's always a spot welcome for you here.
Careful what you wish for.
I'm going to go watch La La Land again right after this. It's going to be very fun.
All right. Thank you guys for listening to Musicals with Cheese. We'll see you next week.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.